Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. I am coming to you once again from the air-conditioned, feline-infested comfort of the coast-to-coast command bunker, and can say with confidence that tonight we will be delivering the goods, dispatches from the front lines of ufology, secrecy, cover-ups, and cabals. This month is, of course, the 70th anniversary of the Roswell incident. No one's quite sure what crashed out there in the desert or exactly where or how many crashes there were, bodies or no bodies, but we're still arguing about it 70 years later. 50 years ago this month, it was the summer of love. The counterculture flourished. Hippies walking around with flowers in their hair, Sgt. Pepper's album wafting in the air. I didn't mean for that to rhyme. One segment of society broke away from the mainstream, rejected its values. We are still dealing with that split, still fighting some of those battles over cultural divides. 10 years ago this month, not to compare it with those other events, but 10 years ago this month, I was invited by Lisa Lyon and George Norrie to become a regular part of the Coast to Coast team. And I don't know the exact date of the first show I did when I was part of the team. I may have sat in for a couple of guest hosting spots earlier in 06, but not entirely sure. But I sincerely hope that everyone forgot about those shows and that the recordings were erased because they were pretty bad. And I am still amazed that I made the cut. And here we are, still learning as we go. In the decades since, you know, we've tackled UFOs from just about every angle on the program. And many of the same issues and challenges that have always plagued ufology have come up again and again on this program, during shows that I have helmed in different guises, voices, maybe using different terminology, but it's the same. The same values get tested, the same suspicions get aroused, and, the same unidentified fingerprints are kind of detected at the scene of the crime, if you know what I mean. This weekend was a busy one here in Las Vegas. We had something called Freedom Fest at the convention center. 20,000 libertarians arguing about all sorts of issues. And, you know, if they like liberty, they came to the right place. This is personal liberty central. Big rumors spread like wildfire this weekend, started during the week and then grew. There were these internet stories that a UFO had crashed near Nellis Air Force Base. Could have happened late Wednesday night. Maybe it was Thursday. It starts picking up steam. And if it's not a UFO, then they speculated it was a black project, a secret plane or platform crashed. Men with machine guns sealed off the area. Black helicopters flying over neighborhoods. People supposedly ordered to stay inside their homes. I started getting emails and messages on Facebook and then phone calls, then frantic appeals from people around the country. Hey, check this out. This is big. It just so happens I live about a mile from where this supposedly occurred. Hollywood and Lake Mead are the main streets, east side of the Las Vegas Valley. So I jammed out there to take a look around. And what I found was a lot of rubberneckers, a lot of people getting out of their cars, walking around in the desert, looking over at Nellis, looking in the desert to see what they could see. And, you know, there's teenagers who were parked up there enjoying the city lights. It's a great place to look at the valley, kind of make it out. But no military crash retrieval effort, no crash site, no area sealed off by armed personnel. Story didn't check out. Coincidentally, while that rumor is flashing around, on the other side of the valley, on the west side of town, the Mutual UFO Network was gathering to hold its annual international symposium. And the theme this year was the secret space program. Do we, or some unknown group, have an entirely different space program, separate from NASA? Using advanced technology that is not acknowledged, maybe advanced stuff that we developed on our own, or technology that was reverse engineered from crash sites. So a panel of speakers was assembled to kick it around, debate and discuss whether it's true. And then beyond that sort of that level of discussion, there was another level of dialogue, another level entirely. Speakers for whom this subject is not a mystery, not a question. Because they say they were part of it, part of the Secret Space Program. They were assigned to the equivalent of like Starfleet. They zipped around the cosmos. They spent years on Mars, even traveled through time. And because of this time travel tech, the people in their own families never knew they were gone. 20 years on Mars went by in a flash. It's just like they went to the bathroom. Oh, and Barack Obama was there too. He was one of the youngsters in this program. That's the story. So the theme was, I think, probably a bit of a stretch for MUFON. And some of its members, I think, let them hear about it. It's a far from, you know, nuts and bolts flying saucers or stories about alien encounters or alien abductions. MUFON has been well-regarded in the UFO field for a long time, but it's tough to keep an organization like this together for decades, basically forever, especially when people have so many other options for where they get their UFO information these days and for the public. You know, maybe this was a stretch, but of course, you know, they want the public to be challenged and interested. They want people to attend to support MUFON, and I understand that. So I wrote a story for our TV news about the gathering, and it's not to say I endorsed any of the speaker's claims, but kind of to let people know what was happening, that the event was underway. And I was not able to get to the conference myself because I hosted Coast to Coast last night and tonight, just had too much stuff to prep for both programs. So I thought we would get a report on what happened from one of the people directly involved, not only in the conference, but in the larger discussion that was underway about whether this topic, the secret space program and UFOs, whether it's suffered because it's embraced tales which cannot be substantiated whatsoever. Historian Richard Dolan has spoken many times in the past about what he calls a breakaway civilization and the possibility that a secret space program may have been developed. He's not a newcomer to this topic, but, you know, based on the article he wrote in advance of the MUFON event, it's clear that he was somewhat uncomfortable with some of the claims being made by persons who were, in effect, on the same stage as he. So I asked Richard to join us tonight, tell us what went down and about the position he has staked out, and about the grief he almost certainly is going to take because of that position. And while we're at it, I wanted to ask him about his most recent book, something he's included in recent lectures, Disclosure. And not just sort of generic UFO disclosure, but disclosure in the age of Trump. Would the keepers of the secrets tell this president? And if they did, could he keep it to himself? What are the various scenarios there? Should be fun to get into that, and I'll try to carve out some time so a few of you are able to call in and join that fray too. Richard Dolan coming up in just a couple of minutes. Then in the second half of the program tonight, a first-time guest to Coast, former police officer John Hansen, who has spent the last 15 years on a quest worthy of Quixote. He's collected what amounts to an encyclopedia of UFO cases from the UK and beyond. And this collection now amounts to 12 volumes, I think, illustrated, documented, interviews with the witnesses, original news clips, an amazing collection of material, an enormous undertaking. And the fact that he's never been on this program is astonishing, given the work that he's done. John Hansen joins me in the second half tonight. Our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, and I have put together our usual assortment of items and oddities. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast to Coast website. Tonight, several stories related to space exploration. Sorry to be self-serving, but Lex posted my TV story about the MUFON event. It introduces some of the prominent speakers and themes and includes an interview with MUFON's executive director, Jan Harzan, who is a guy I respect and who has a very tough job. The term herding cats comes to mind. The story does not endorse the claims that are being made as being true, just gives a taste of kind of let the public know the event was underway and a bit of background. Also there, Naps News, a story which alleges the elite of the planet, billionaires and such, a sort of an escape plan, their own ideas of what they would do if doomsday is approaching. And, you know, I think chances are pretty good that you and I won't have a seat on that particular lifeboat. Also, a new report from the Black Vault about the CIA's claims that half of all UFO reports from the 50s and 60s were caused by spy planes, CIA spy planes. Ridiculous. And a story about how NASA was able to send back images of the moon landing, in case you're wondering, or if you think it was, you know, staged out there at Area 51. Here's information you can pick apart. That and more in Naps News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. It's still a great deal. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on almost any device to a vast archive of previous programs, classic episodes. Hopefully not my early disasters, I hope. And you can find out how to subscribe to George Norrie's TV show as well. And with that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and cat inside the cool AC. Put on a strong pot of mud so you're amped for the long haul tonight. Slip into those silky jammies and fuzzy loafers. Plop down in a comfy place. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, historian Richard Dolan, secret space program or not. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. As mentioned, MUFON held its annual international symposium here in Las Vegas this weekend. I hope many of the attendees are worn out from enjoying all that Las Vegas has to offer, and you're tuned in tonight to the program. I know a lot of folks made side trips to Area 51 in a bus. You folks, you're welcome here in Las Vegas anytime. Wish I could have been there with you. One person who was there and right in the middle of things is my first guest tonight. Well known to our audience, Richard Dolan is among the world's leading UFO researchers, historians, and publishers. Anyone who has a UFO library should have his two-volume set, UFOs and the National Security State, mandatory reading for anybody who takes this topic seriously. He has a variety of media projects in the works that I hope we can ask him about. And his most recent book is UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era. He is a credible guy, a meticulous researcher, and someone whose opinion I trust and value. Richard, welcome back to the program.
George, thank you for having me on. And it was a shame that you couldn't be at the MUFON symposium this weekend.
I'm sure you got out and had great dinners and enjoyed all that Las Vegas has to offer and had a great time, right?
Not yet. Hopefully tomorrow. It's been a busy weekend.
You've been at this long enough now where you get invited to speak all over the world. I would think just about any conference that's organized anywhere has you near the top of their list of people to invite. And in the beginning, I guess you're starting out like others. Maybe you're not as selective. You're glad to be invited. You want to get exposure. You want to meet everyone. But at this point, you've been at it for a while. Are you apprehensive about the other people who might share the stage with you? Do you look at a conference lineup?
It has happened, and I think you're referring to this particular conference. Normally I do try to I try to know where I'm going and what I'm heading into when I do an event. Sometimes I don't always get it the right way, but usually I try to be very careful. In the particular case of this MUFON symposium, I had spoken quite a bit at MUFON, and in the last few years, just for various reasons, hadn't been at a MUFON symposium as a speaker, and I was invited to speak this year, and I was glad to accept the invitation. That was about 6 months ago or so, and I was asked, and I've mentioned this in my article I recently put out on this, by Jan Harzan, the director of MUFON, if I would speak explicitly on the secret space program. And to be honest with you, it wasn't really my first choice. It wasn't something that I was actively going into. I've looked into this in the past. I've written a bit about it. I've spoken about it, and I thought I'd rather move on to other things. But he asked, and I said, all right, I'll do it. I'll develop some new insights, new research. It was only several months later that I learned that I was going to be on at a panel with a number of other individuals whose claims that I have considered to be questionable. I guess I'll put it that way. And not only that, but that I was going to be on a panel with them. And that panel, in fact, took place today. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to be on a panel with some of these folks, and it's not that I'm out to have a war or have a cage match or a throwdown with anyone, I'm not interested in that in the least. But I also felt that I really was going to have to start being a little bit more forthright in my own opinions about what I think is going on here. Why are these individuals, why are they speaking at the MUFON symposium? And I'm not trying to say this in a confrontational way. And I felt it was important that I would distinguish my own position on this matter from theirs. And so to name names, and there's really no harm in doing that since everything's been out there anyway. We're talking, people like Corey Good, who's talked about going to Mars and back in the 20-year and back program. Andrew Basiago, who has talked for many years about going to Mars in what he calls the jump room, having done so as early as the 1980s with a young Barack Obama. The 94-year-old William Tompkins, who has a different kind of story, but also very, in a lot of ways, challenging and difficult for some people to accept, and also not some of the more core parts of the story really tough to get evidence for. And the researcher Michael Sala, who has written about all of those individuals in a supportive way. So those four people and myself were on this panel. And again, I just thought, look, I got to put myself out there and make a clear statement about where I think we're going, where ufology needs to go in this area, and what really constitutes valid evidence, I think is a fair question to ask. So that's framing the whole thing. And yeah, so I was a bit concerned going into it. I guess I could say that's true.
I just got a text from Jan Harzan. I like the guy. I wouldn't take his job for $1 million a year. It's a tough job. And he told me that this was the best attended MUFON symposium in 20 years, and that there was a very lively debate. So is that how you'd describe it, a very lively debate on in particular on this panel?
Yeah, I would say it was very well attended. And so, look, I mean, Jan will tell you what his motivation was, whatever, but, I mean, I would say this was very well designed to bring in maximum numbers of people. Lots of people are interested in talking about the secret space program these days. It's very much a hot topic, so it's not surprising to me. The debate itself, let's call it a debate. We can call it a discussion, however one wants to. It's basically, it was me sitting on one end of the table and everyone else there. So I think it was framed kind of as a debate, myself with these other four gentlemen. I think it was lively. I think I made certain points that I really challenged the other individuals in a particular way. And I think, you know, the main thing for me is, look, as a UFO researcher, I'm very well aware of what it is like to be considered on the fringe and having to deal with a skeptical world that, you know, thinks a lot of this is silliness anyway. So it's incumbent upon me as a researcher to provide evidence and to provide something for someone who's not knowledgeable to be able to bite into and to be able to, you know, analyze and to examine. If I can't do that, then I don't really deserve the title of a UFO researcher, it seems to me. And so what I said, this is toward the end of the debate or discussion, let's call it that, was that it's incumbent upon these alleged whistleblowers to do the same thing. If they are going to make claims that are they expect other people to believe, then we need more than a good story. We need evidence. We need something that we can examine, that we can either accept or reject. And if we have no opportunity to examine evidence, then it really can't count as evidence. It could be true. It could entirely be, you know, some of the more outrageous stories can be true. Look, in my examination into this now, it's a little over 20 years, and you've been doing this even longer than that, we all realize that behind, around this little fence that we're, the society's placed within, like told, this is what you're supposed to believe, beyond that fence is probably some really wild stuff and could be a very, very sophisticated infrastructure as well. So we acknowledge all of that, but still it's incumbent upon us as researchers and investigators to be able to provide evidence that the rest of the world has the opportunity to examine. If someone tells me that they go to Mars for 20 years, but, you know, ordinarily I think, wow, that's a really amazing thing. Now let's investigate your claim. Where, you know, when were you gone? When were you off of Earth? And then you discover, oh, no, well, they were really never off of Earth. They were age-regressed and time-regressed right back within minutes of having left, and so no one in the family knew they ever left the house. Well, that makes it very easy for you to make whatever statement you want, and it makes it impossible for me to verify your claim. And so that's what's called non-falsifiable evidence. And it's, you know, any scientist would tell you this is not valid form of evidence.
Is it for you a bridge too far for MUFON to include those guys on his speaker list? It's a far cry from, you know, what the norm has been.
It is a far, yes, it's a far cry from where MUFON has been traditionally. That is absolutely true. I don't know. I mean, this is a question I think Jan should answer, or someone else in the MUFON leadership should answer. I'm not part of that. I do think MUFON is going down a dangerous road if they want to continue, you know, really damaging a scientific reputation with claims that are not, technically speaking, scientific. And the claims may be true, they may be false, but they're not scientific. Like, no academician, philosopher, scientist would say that these are fall within scientific discourse. And so it's a dangerous road, I guess I would say that.
Yeah, I mean, MUFON, since its birth has been grasping to achieve scientific credibility, to get scientists to come on board. Hold that thought for a second. We're going to take a break here. And Del Shannon from 1961, it's a good theme song for a breakaway civilization. It's called Runaway. We'll be right back with Richard Dolan talking about the secret space program on Coast to Coast AM. Beatles, Back in the USSR, a song that kind of harkens back to the halcyon days of the Cold War. You know, that war is supposedly over, gone, done. So is the USSR, for that matter. But, of course, Russia on our minds very much these days, friend or foe. Historian Richard Dolan has written extensively about the relationships between the U.S., Russia, China, and the other so-called keepers of the UFO secrets, how it all fits together. In a bit, we're going to get into the issue of disclosure in the era of Trump, which is the subject he addressed in his most recent book, Richard Dolan, that is. Before that, though, we're going to stick around and talk a little bit more about the secret space programs and some of the claims that were made at this MUFON symposium this weekend in Las Vegas. We'll be right back. We're back with Richard Dolan. You know, our colleague Stan Friedman has often been called the UFO cop on the beat. He sort of assigns himself to weed out frauds and tricksters and other folks whose stories are not very good. You're not that guy, Richard. You're not the cop on the beat. But you wrote in this article that that you put out a little bit ago that you felt like you needed to stand up on this particular issue because it does sort of flow from a theme that you have developed as much or more than anyone.
Yes, I guess you're talking about the breakaway civilization.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's true, George. I don't own the concept. It's just something that I developed a number of years ago, and other people have taken it and run with it, and that's fine. But what I felt a real need to defend isn't really that idea so much as to help defend ufology itself, if I can say that. I mean, this is a field in which, when you look around, you look out at a skeptical establishment and media and political establishment, I feel would still love nothing more than to see this study just lying in ruins. I think there's a lot of forces out there that have us in their crosshairs, and they would like to see genuine UFO research fail. And, you know, I think it's incumbent upon all researchers to be responsible, to not have to be perfect. We all can make mistakes, but at least to do our best and to provide evidence, again, to a world that wants that evidence, and rather than simply making claims that really have no opportunity at all of being substantiated. So what I said, and I guess this could be a challenge, or it was a call to the other individuals who are making these claims, is simply, it doesn't really even matter if I believe you or disbelieve you. I might not believe all of your claims. I might think that some of the claims could be credible. I don't really know. But the fact is, if I can't test it, if I can't examine it, then you have a problem. You have to be able to provide evidence that the rest of us can be able to do something with. And that's the important thing. That's what we have to remind ourselves of. The idea of a breakaway civilization, I think, is it's a hypothesis. I've always considered it that, but I think it's valid. I think it's true. That is an idea that the classified world, the black budget world, has got access to technology that is well beyond what we have in our society. And I do think that is true. You know, I say what I say as a believer in the likelihood of a secret space program. I think that there is probably one. And the evidence that I use is a combination of a few different things. I mean, there are NASA insiders over the years, verifiable individuals whose backgrounds we can confirm, who've talked about discussions within NASA, high levels, through the early 1970s and even in the late 60s, about all of the Apollo and Gemini, you know, flights being tracked by UFOs. And we've got claims of a number of individuals, of astronauts encountering them even on the moon. These stories are not simply isolated stories. There are quite a few individuals at NASA and highly connected to NASA who've talked about this. And that's interesting to me. Furthermore, right off the bat, you've got this, if this is true, you've got a motivation for a secret space program. Clearly, if there's something else that's out there, the powers that be would want to be able to deal with that with some level of secrecy. On top of that, you've got good and confirmed testimony of individuals who, while in the United States Air Force, for example, I'm thinking of the case of Simone Mendez, a lady that I spoke to some years ago. She was in the U.S. Air Force at Nellis.
Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, she had a top secret clearance in 1981. She was given a top secret message stating that NORAD had detected deep space objects entering Earth's atmosphere. This is a true story. She got a lot of hell for this, and her documents are confirmed. There have been FOIA requests, and absolutely proving that this indeed happened to her. And so now, what was that all about? We've got the a number of other accounts of astronauts, cosmonauts, having seen anomalies in Earth orbit. So I think that there's no question that something has been observed that would prompt a secret space program. On top of that, we've got a great deal of evidence of crash retrievals of various UFOs. And again, I always say to someone who's not familiar with the evidence that I think they would be shocked if they took some time to go through the many, many accounts of this having happened and how those accounts have come to us over the years. There's quite a few of them, and we don't know that all of them are true, but there are so many good ones that have been collected over the years that I think, to me, it's a very, very strong case that the U.S. military has been retrieving and studying non-human alien tech and bodies as well. And in fact, you know, Edgar Mitchell, recently deceased Apollo 14 astronaut, for a while was making very explicit statements exactly to that effect. He said he had two ultra-high-level contacts who confirmed to him explicitly the existence of programs to study alien technology and bodies, but Edgar Mitchell wasn't the only one to do that, to say that. So if you put all of this together, and then you've got the aerospace journalists, people like James Goodall, people like yourself, who have interviewed countless insiders out of Groom Lake and in the area, I think the case is overwhelming that there has been a program to develop radical technologies that are off-limits to the rest of our society, classified patents and so forth, unconventional technologies. So when you look at all of that, and then stories which I credit, like the alien reproduction vehicle story of 1988, brought to us by Mark McCandlish and his colleague Brad Sorensen. These I think, are credible accounts dealing with the attempts to replicate non-human technology and to take us off Earth orbit. So all of these things tell me that there's something very likely, very radical, that is going on beyond our officially sanctioned truth. So I don't need to be convinced that there are some extreme possibilities. But again, when we get to a point where there are individuals who are claiming direct experience, well, on one hand, you could say it would be logical if you assume that there are such programs that exist. It could be that there would be people from those programs who would say, hey, I was part of it. So on that one hand, it would be logical. On the other hand, those individuals, again, have got to provide something. They've got to provide, even family members, for goodness sake, that would be able to vouch for them. You know, the individuals who have come forward who have alleged to have participated haven't really done anything of the sort. So the rest of us are here saying, okay, great, you've got a story. Let's get your evidence. And if you can't provide the evidence, then come back to us when you've got it.
I think I kind of thought that it was going to go away. You know, I heard these rumbles in 2014 when this stuff started, and I think there's no way this story can go on. Nobody's going to believe this. I mean, the part of it, you wrote about it in your article, one of the guys says he went back to see Abe Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Now, come on.
Well, this was Andrew Basiago, and he's made this claim for many years. I saw Andy this weekend. You know, it's interesting for me because when you meet these people, and in the case of Andy, it's impossible not to like him personally. He's a very, very nice, genial guy, and very articulate as well. But I said to him personally, and I'm saying here to you, that I don't believe that claim. I don't find it credible. You know, just because someone says, yes, I went back in time and there's me in the picture right there, sorry, but that doesn't cut it whatsoever. It's not evidence. And to call it evidence tells me that you don't really know what evidence truly is.
You know, I was worried for MUFON itself and you as well for the larger topic of ufology. It's hard enough. It's, you know, the organization is scratching and clawing to try to get to respectability and inviting scientific scrutiny. And please take us seriously. The media doesn't, and a lot of science doesn't. And now you hand those people who don't like it already something like this. What happens? I mean, I'm glad MUFON had really great attendance, best in 20 years. But what happens next year? Do you have to have lap dances?
No, I totally take your point. And you know, I'll just say this publicly. When I realized what was going on, I originally agreed to speak many, many months ago. And then essentially stopped paying attention. I was moving on to other things. And then discovered that I was going to be on a panel with these individuals. And I really wondered, is this something that I want to do? And the thought occurred to me of just not doing it. And in fact, the number of people, you know, I look at comments on social media, YouTube, and so forth, and there are people who've questioned, like, why would Richard Dolan do such a thing? But I opted to do it, and I'm very glad that I did it. And in fact, when I talked with Jan Harzen privately about this a couple of months ago about my concerns, and he said, do you want me to pull you from the panel? And I said, no, I don't want to be pulled from that panel. I want to be on that panel. I feel like I need to be on that panel. And so at that point, I just took it as a mission, something that I felt that I needed to do. And I will tell you that there are a large number of MUFON attendees and longtime MUFON members who told me privately that they were very grateful, very glad that I was on that panel. They felt that I was representing them. And it wasn't for me to put myself in that position, but I was just placed in that position. And I felt an obligation to represent the ideals of responsible research the best that I could, and that's what I tried to do.
You know, I remember back in the late 80s when it was a heady experience when I was first really kind of jumping into the deep end of this pool, and I got invited to be on this TV show, a nationally syndicated talk show, and there was a whole bunch of panel of people that were going to come on in front of me. A couple of them were people I consider a little bit shady. I'll stick it out. I'll go ahead. It's worth the exposure. Get the story out there. What they hadn't told me is right before I came on, and in addition to researchers who sort of bent the rules and then some alien abductees, and I had no problem with that, the people right in front of me were earthbound extraterrestrials. That is, they said that they had been aliens in a previous life. Now, you know, what do you do with that? And I regretted being on it.
So it's impossible to confirm such stories. Again, this is just what someone claims. Anyone can make a claim like that, and it's wonderful for them because you and I cannot disprove such a claim. And so it's up to the rest of us to decide what is it that constitutes valid evidence. And these are questions we should always be asking, particularly in this, the greatest of mysteries, which is the UFO subject. It really, honestly, is the most incredible mystery in our era, maybe in any era. But for that reason, we've got to ask ourselves what constitutes valid evidence, and we need to do it all the time. Otherwise, this is a field that attracts all kinds of shady characters. It always has. Back when you broke in the 80s, and I broke into this field about 10 years after that, and it has never stopped. And it also has to be said, and I don't know if this is the case with any of the folks that I've been dealing with this weekend, but there are people who are delusional. There are people who are mentally unstable. There are people who lie. And all of those people exist. They've always existed throughout human history, and they will always exist throughout the rest of human history. That's just how people are. And so just because someone has an interesting story, a fun story, it doesn't mean it's true. In the article you referenced earlier that I wrote, I wrote about an old friend of mine. I went to school with this guy years ago. One of my best friends, brilliant, fun, a good friend who just happened, and I only learned this after he died, that he was a pathological liar. He came up with all kinds of stories about himself. He was a piano player, but he had turned himself into this like really great piano player who had done all kinds of impressive recitals for all sorts of impressive people. Said he had studied at Juilliard, said he was a member of the DuPont family, and I believed my friend. I was in my 20s, I was a lot younger, and I thought, well, he's such a great guy. I probably had hundreds of cups of coffee with him over a few years, and he really was brilliant, and he was reliable. I thought, well, he's clearly telling me the truth. Well, he died tragically. And one of our colleagues did some research on him and found everything was false. His mom was a secretary at DuPont. He was not in the DuPont family. He did not go to Juilliard. He did not do a grand recital for, wait for it, Queen Elizabeth. Yes, he said that. I mean, but did that make him a bad person? And the lesson that I learned is that good people can sometimes tell complete nonsensical tall tales because who knows why? Because they just like to do it. It didn't make.
There's a darker angle, though, too. I mean, we're not saying it about these three guys, but, you know, over the years in this topic, there have been people who have told stories to confuse and muddy the waters, and they were doing it at the behest of someone else, someone with an agenda.
It happens. That's right. And the other thing that we can add to just tack on top of that is that the United States government has had a history for decades and generations and an entire human lifetime of sending in disinformation agents. So we have COINTELPRO and then FBI during the 1950s and 60s and 70s. That's fact. We have, less than a decade ago under the Obama administration, Cass Sunstein, one of his top lawyers and judges, openly talking about the need to infiltrate dangerous organizations that are anti-government with conspiracy theories and infiltrating them with provocateurs to derail those organizations. So think, what is ufology if it's not something that encourages questioning the government and so-called conspiracy theories? So people in all of these alternative fields need to be aware that, that governments, and particularly the United States government, has a long history of actively creating disinformation to derail citizen movements. And they've done this all the time, and we have to expect that they will continue to do this. So that doesn't mean that I don't know if any of these individuals are involved in such activities, and they may not be. But either way, it is still incumbent upon them to provide evidence that can be verified, at the very least, and for the rest of us to hold some standards of evidence so that we don't get taken in by the next rumor that hits our Facebook page.
Yeah, I'm all for free and open debate. So, and that's what Jan Harzan had said. Look, we'll let them say their piece and then the audience can ask questions and we'll see where it goes. So,
if that being the case, I will say for the MUFON crowd, my estimation is that the large majority of attendees seriously questioned the accounts of Andrew and Corey in particular, and I think Bill Tompkins as well. I didn't do a statistical survey, and it's very likely that the skeptical people were more likely to come to me and maybe a few other people. But I did get a very strong sense that there was a lot of skepticism among attendees about those particular claims, yeah.
Skepticism in this field is a good thing. That doesn't mean debunking, but
absolutely,
it is a good thing. It's a good thing to have with you. And if this event and this topic, fringe as it may be, attracted a whole bunch of new people to the subject matter, good for them.
Well, and they ended up encountering a lot of good debates, and not just with me. There were a lot of other individuals out there. The conversations were out there the whole weekend. I think it was very good for the attendees. I would like for some of this to appear like on YouTube. I would love to see this out there. I think the rest of the world would like to see what we did this weekend.
Where do we find the article you wrote? I want to post it on Coast.
Oh,
so
thanks. Well, my main website is richardolanpress.com. And I've got a blog site that's connected to it, and that article is on that, and I think I called it On Corey, Andy, and the Whistleblowers. I posted it on my Facebook feed, but not everyone can get to that, I suppose. But on richardolanpress.com, you can just check it out. It's very easy to see.
Great. Well, this happens. I mean, these guys are telling this story at a really interesting time for this subject. There are a lot of moving pieces right now,
right.
A lot of things going on, and I'm sure you're feeling it and hearing it as well. When we come back, we'll jump into some of that. We'll get into your latest book, UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era, and ask you to sort of describe some of the possible scenarios that you see coming down the road. We'll be right back with more of our conversation with Richard Dolan in a moment. And John Fogerty takes us into the break with his song Mystic Highway. He's been a guest on the show, and he listens all the time. I hope he's listening tonight. We'll be right back. Great song, Your Wildest Dreams from 1986. That's the Moody Blues, still not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We'll see about that. We're talking with Richard Dolan, historian, writer, UFO researcher. His latest book is called UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era. And it sort of capsulizes what's going on in ufology now, the situation we find ourselves in. It sort of feels like, based on interviews that we've had over the last couple of months on this program, over the last year, that there are a lot of moving pieces, things in motion. Kind of feels like there's a buzz behind the scenes, but it's felt like that before. In fact, several times, and nothing ever comes of it. Richard writes about that in his book. When we come back, we're going to jump into it with the added wild card of Trump. Coast to Coast continues in just a moment. By the way, folks, anybody who wants to read Richard Dolan's article on Corey, Andrew, and the whistleblowers, that's the title. Lex Lonehood just tweeted it out on the Coast Twitter feed. Before we jump into the book, Richard, I wanted to ask you, how's life? I mean, I haven't seen you in person for a while now, and, you know, I see bits and pieces on social media and things. Seems like things are going well for you.
Thank you, George. I'm doing great. I'm engaged. I'm very, very happy in my personal life. I've got a wonderful fiance named Tracy Garbutt. It's been wonderful. It's been a wonderful ride for me. I've been very lucky to be with her. In every other way, research is good, friends good. I'm a happy guy. very optimistic, looking forward to the future and looking forward to many more years of productive work in this field of UFOs and things related to it. I'm working on a book right now. I've been working on it for a little while on the history of false flag operations. It's totally different from anything in the UFO field, but it's important.
There's a TV show, or you have a series like with that title, right?
Well, I just wrote and hosted, and it's about to air, I understand, a TV series of false flags for Gaia TV. And I'm looking forward to seeing that come out finally. It took a lot of effort. It's part of the research that I did for the book that I'm working on. So that ought to be out, I think, in the next couple of weeks, and that's on GaiaTV.com.
And so any day now, I'm going to get National Security State Volume 3, too, right?
Any day. Maybe next week. I'll be working on it as soon as possible. I can tell you that.
Do you have a sense of the level of public interest in the general topic? Is it different?
I think that people are actually quite interested in this. You know, I broke into this. I was researching this field back in the 90s, and I felt back then that, my goodness, I couldn't let anyone know that I was researching UFOs. I don't feel that way anymore. I think that there's actually a much broader willingness among the population to engage in this topic. There's not a lot of knowledge beyond kind of cultural cliches in Hollywood and things like that, but I do think, I feel like that there's a hunger for truth among people, and that they discover it when they meet people who dedicate themselves to the truth, and they realize, oh, wow, there's someone who actually knows a lot about this. I want to know more. And I'm only saying this because in my life, when I encounter new individuals all the time, I see the light bulbs go on over their head every time. After I've spoken with them for 5 minutes, they think, wow, this guy knows a lot about UFOs. I want to know more about it. That's fascinating. And so I think there's an instinct that people have that what they're getting in the mainstream kind of, you know, news and information isn't quite right. There's something desperately wrong with that. So I do feel that increasingly people are willing to recognize that that this is a topic that's actually worthwhile. And there's still a lot of dismissal in the corporate world and in the mainstream world, but I don't know how much people are really accepting that increasingly. I feel that there's some changes happening culturally.
Yeah, you know, I've been on the air here in Las Vegas on television for 30-some years, and I've done thousands of stories, and some of them are pretty big and had rippled out through the community. But everywhere I go, when people stop me in a grocery store or at a traffic light or something, at the urinal in the men's room, they want to ask about UFOs. And it's not so much to find out my opinion. It's more to tell me their UFO story.
There's, oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I get that all the time.
Yeah. Does it feel, you write in this book, UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era, that there have been other eras that felt like this one, that where there, it feels like there's something, a buzz going on, and then somebody pulls the rug out from under.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the history of the UFO phenomenon in the modern era, to be honest with you. I mean, any decade since World War II, there has been a kind of crescendo and a crash dealing with the imminent disclosure of the UFO reality. They weren't calling it disclosure in the 50s, but it was the same basic idea. So in the 1950s, there was an upsurge in sightings in the early 50s, particularly 1952 and a few of the other years. And it got to the point in 52 where people within the military, we have this from Edward Ruppelt, who was there at the time, Air Force captain, Project Blue Book, who stated that there were people in the military who were actually thinking that this was going to come out that summer, and it didn't come out that summer. There were civilian organizations, most notably NICAP in the 50s and 60s, that pushed hard, as hard as they were able to anyway, for UFO disclosure, what we would call that. NICAP got the idea that they were going to have congressional hearings. It was a logical idea in 1960, that whole era, when you could believe back then that the United States congressional system was actually functioning and we had a system of representative democracy. You thought, well, okay, we've got elected officials, let's use them to have this discussion come out in the public. So, and NICAP tried, and every moment at the 11th hour when they thought they were going to have hearings, it didn't happen. And then through the remainder of the 60s with the upsurge in UFO sightings, and that led to the Air Force sponsoring the Condon Committee, this so-called scientific investigation of UFOs, and that raised hopes, and that was dashed. Really, the Condon Committee was a rigged game. Then come the 1970s, and we get the Freedom of Information Act greatly strengthened, and researchers, again, by the late 70s thought, we might just be able to shake that tree enough and the right document will fall out, and we might just be able to get that key piece of evidence to force the government to admit this is real. And what you ended up having in the 70s and into the early 80s was a lot of great documents did come out, and it really did expose the cover-up, very much so, but it still did not get an admission from the government. And then through the 90s, as we start getting into the beginnings of the Internet era, there were more and more rumors. And, you know, you were part of that through your investigation of people like Bob Lazar and other insiders who had claims that were coming out, and it caused a very major buzz. I wasn't in the field in 1990, but I certainly went back over the journals, and I could read it all happening right before my eyes, where people had the idea, once again, that these insiders were going to blow the secret wide open, and again, it did not happen. And then now in our own century, there, you know, the disclosure era, maybe we can call it, where you have the press conference organized by Stephen Greer in 2001 and a whole slew of press conferences after that in the 2000s with the idea of getting this topic out into the public domain, forcing the government to admit, and on. It has never ceased. It's just taken on new forms. And there's always been this crescendo of hope. And, it, you know, there's just been disappointment, and this has happened. It doesn't mean that we'll be disappointed forever. It's my opinion that we are living in a very revolutionary era. So much has changed, and I think we would be very foolish to think that tomorrow is going to look like today. I mean, we've just gone through so many changes. So that with new technologies, new abilities to communicate with ourselves globally, the ability to rip digital data out, you know, give information to organizations like WikiLeaks to throw it out there. All of these are capabilities which exist now that did not exist 10, 20 years ago, much less 30 or 40 years ago. So the game is constantly changing, and that makes for a very unstable situation where a lot can happen. So I think we can never rule out a surprise disclosure. But having said that, despite the fact that we have a new president and maybe some new things going on, I think that it's a very much a long shot to expect any kind of voluntary disclosure of the UFO reality anytime soon.
It's felt like Lucy pulling the football back from Charlie Brown over and over, we keep going for it. But of course, you want to be there in the front row if or when it happens. That's how I felt about it. So you go back to the trough. You keep on trying. You write in this book, I mean, it's pretty harsh about the structure of our government in regard to secrecy and how things really operate. You call it an oligarchy, especially in reference to the keepers of these particular secrets, the national security state. They would jealously guard this this particular secret, perhaps above all others, for very human reasons.
Yes, I guess that's accurate. You know, we have a system of government that we like to call representative. We like to call it a democratic type of government or a republican type of government. But I think we really have to, you know, ask ourselves, what do these words mean? In the 21st century, we're in 2017 now, in a world where increasingly the true structure of power doesn't seem to me to be in our elected institutions so much as in financial power, certainly banks, financial institutions, and in transnational, multinational corporations, which have more power than most nations in the world, probably. So it's a new world with a new forms of power, where power is, I think, increasingly really behind the scenes, and where political institutions are being used by private financial power for their own benefit. So I can call that an oligarchy for sure. These individuals, you know, they meet. They have the infamous Bilderberg meetings. That's a real thing, where they get together and they discuss the kind of world that they want to shape. And these people aren't elected. They're a very, very small group of people who make their decisions. There are other similar organizations as well, whether you want to talk about the Council on Foreign Relations, trilaterals, and so forth. They are real. They exist. And it's a small little club. And these people do make decisions. So relating to the UFO matter, we can ask ourselves, are these the people who manage the UFO secret? And I don't have the answer to that explicitly. I don't know anyone who really has that answer. But we can glean a few things. The general scenario that I see is essentially where there have been crash retrievals and military encounters with these objects. I think that part is very, very easy to argue. That has created a system of very complete secrecy and the need to control this powerful secret. People can just ask, well, why doesn't the president tell the world that UFOs are real? Why would they want to keep this secret? But if you go back to the 1940s and put yourself in the position of a guy like Harry Truman, who was president back then, and, you know, just pretend you're him and your top generals have now told you, this is real. We've recovered alien technology and, indeed, bodies. Would you tell the world? That's a heavy thing to lay down, in particular when you don't have all the answers and you've got now technology that's exotic and maybe you don't want to share that with the Russians or other people. So you might just keep it to yourself and study it. That would create a very powerful secret, and it's a fair question to ask, how would that secret ever be undone? It creates black budget agencies, secret spending, probably illegal criminal financing of that black budget.
You document the dollar amounts on the illegal drug trade that has been tapped by intelligence agencies in the past. It's
we know numbers. This has happened. We know that intel agencies around the world, not just the U.S., but they're all in love with drug money. It's one of the largest industries in the world. Who doesn't want that money? If you want to overthrow governments, rig elections, raise secret armies, my goodness, you want your stash that's unvouchered. And if you want to study this technology off the records, off the books, then yes, it helps. And so there's all of this going on. It's a huge, huge scenario, and people will ask, well, how can you keep this from the media? How do you keep this from the academic community? It's not as hard as people think. It's just not that hard. I mean, all you have to do is look at something like Project Operation Mockingbird, which was during the Cold War. The U.S. government, CIA, managed hundreds of U.S. journalists, had them on the payroll. Mockingbird's successors continue to exist. There have been study after study proving that the U.S. intelligence community is deeply involved in influencing and indeed controlling medias around the world. So this is the real world. So in that world, which we call a representative democratic system, but which in reality is something very different from that, it is that structure which is dealing with the UFO secret. And we have to keep reminding ourselves that. So when we talk about disclosure, we can't really look at it the way people looked at it in the 1950s, where they thought, oh, well, I've got a representative government, my member of Congress is going to answer to me. And I don't think it works like that. That's not the system. Congress exists, but how much power does it really have? other than perhaps a little bit of window dressing. And
and who is it working for?
Who's it working for? So if you don't like the bums, you throw them out, but does that really make any difference? Those bums then go off working in lobbying firms and aerospace and defense contractors, and they don't really care if they get voted out of office, frankly. So the system is what it is. And so that's part of what we're dealing with, and we can really ask ourselves legitimately, how do you get such a system to move forward toward a genuine political disclosure? Back in 2013, I participated in the citizens' hearing on disclosure organized by Stephen Bassett in Washington, D.C., and one of the panel members was former Senator of Alaska Mike Gravel, and I will never forget, in the middle of all of this, after being subjected to so much testimony from researchers and military insiders, Mike Gravel just stood up in the middle of all of this and said, I no longer believe in the ability of the United States Congress to do anything positive. He said, I despair of our ability to get control over this situation. And I think it was a moment where he just kind of threw up his hands and said, I just don't know what we can do anymore. So I think that's, unfortunately, kind of the system that we're dealing with. And to make matters more difficult, there is this phenomenon we call UFOs that is a very difficult nut to crack. And within this labyrinthian governmental system is a military that has parts of it that have very limited oversight, what we call the black budget world. And that part seems to be in conjunction with private money, defense contractor money and financial money. And they've got this secret. So that's part of the problem that we're dealing with, yeah.
In your book, you lay out four principal scenarios of how disclosure could happen.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to ask you to go into all of those. I'd just ask you, and we'll go to the break in about, I don't know, mm-hmm. 2 minutes. In the age of Trump, which is part of the title,
right.
The Trump era, if you were the keeper of the secrets, would you tell this president?
Absolutely, yes. I certainly would. And in fact, the thing about Trump that makes him so interesting, you know, all through 2016, people were assuming Hillary Clinton was going to win the White House. I mean, it was almost considered a foregone conclusion. And what made her interesting from a UFO point of view, of course, was that there are these little connections that have occurred, legitimate connections over the years. It was Hillary Clinton's connection to Lawrence Rockefeller in the 1990s when Rockefeller was indeed trying to get some kind of disclosure, we might say, on UFOs from the Clinton White House. There's her campaign manager, John Podesta, who has a very open interest in UFOs. And so there was this idea that maybe Hillary Clinton would be a disclosure president. I never believed that idea, and I was very vocal about it. Trump is a different character altogether, and I'm sure we can talk about this after the break, but and I'm not expecting a Trump disclosure, but this is a guy who, A, he's got a very obvious war with establishment media, that's obvious, and which would give him a potential sympathy with alternative media. He was also a private citizen his whole life, so I don't know this, but I would be shocked if he didn't have an interest to some extent in UFOs. I'd be shocked if he didn't. And, you know, everyone wants to talk about his ego and narcissism. That might be the golden ticket. That could be his Teflon.
Well, it certainly would be
allow him to do it.
It certainly would be a diversion from other things that are going on.
Yeah.
We'll continue our conversation with Richard Dolan in a moment, and phone lines are pretty full. We'll get to some of your calls, questions, and comments as well right after this. 50 years ago this year, the Doors exploded onto the musical scene, and this song kind of led the way. A year later, Jose Feliciano slowed it way down and made it a hit all over again. It's still a beautiful tune. We're talking with Richard Dolan. His latest book is called UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era. If you were the keeper of the secrets, would you tell Donald Trump? Would you worry that he might let it out, if nothing else, to distract from all the rest of the stuff swirling around him? In a moment, we'll get Richard Dolan's opinion on that. Then I go to the phones with your calls and questions and comments. We'll be right back. Richard, I'll let you finish the sort of the discussion about Trump. It occurred to me, if I were the keeper of the secrets, I would worry that if I told him, read him into the program, that given the siege that's underway and all the attacks on him, that it would be such a temptation to go ahead and let it fly, because after that, that's all anyone would talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. It'd be one heck of a distraction. The thing is, the reason that I never thought it would happen with a Hillary Clinton presidency is that disclosure is just so disruptive to the system. I mean, once you let this secret out in any kind of significant way, that yes, UFOs are real and some of them don't belong to us, that opens up everything, and it allows the rest of society to question many things that were never questioned before. So, you know, on the other side of that whole thing, we don't even know where we're going to end up. And it just seemed to me that a Clinton presidency was so clearly an establishment-oriented presidency that it would never happen, no matter what people thought. Trump, it's not that he's a completely anti-establishment character, but as a candidate, he really strongly came across in many ways as anti-establishment. He was certainly the neoconservative and neoliberal sort of paradigm that we've been seeing for the last 20-plus years in U.S. politics, criticizing a lot of the wars, criticizing globalization. I mean, these are the things that have kept the American, that have dominated American policy, and he criticized both of them, whatever one thinks about him. He created the heresy of saying we should be friendly with Russia, you know, God forbid. And the establishment, particularly the military and media, were all after him on that. So with that type of oppositional attitude to the establishment, one might suggest or one might think that Trump would be more likely, not less likely, to introduce something as disruptive as UFO disclosure. And I'm not really saying that he is. I'm thinking he probably won't, particularly now we're seven months into the presidency. And what we've really seen is, in many, many important ways, we've seen some changes, it's true, and we've seen a lot more of the same in many other areas. So whether the deep state has checkmated him, if the CIA has checkmated him, that may be the case. He may not be able to institute the kind of reforms and draining the swamp that he's talked about as a candidate. And if that is the case, then I think disclosure is probably not going to happen in a Trump presidency. But
you know,
a distraction.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen with Tom DeLong. He's going to be making an announcement soon, hopefully on this program. And you know, but I haven't talked to you about this since the WikiLeaks thing, the Podesta emails came out. But a lot of people come into the field, they make claims, they say I've got insiders, I'm dialed in, I know this guy, that guy. That was a pretty big surprise when it came out. Tom had been saying, yeah, I'm in touch with these folks, and then the names came out and sure enough, he really was in touch with those people.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, one question relating to Podesta is just how deeply committed was or is John Podesta to this whole process. And that's the thing that's not really clear to me in reading the emails. And Tom DeLong can talk much more about this than I could, for sure. You know, what we see in the WikiLeaks is that Podesta is really not saying anything in terms of what his attitude truly is. They did a Google Hangout. We know that this happened. So that is interesting, and they talked about this subject, and with the other very high-level people in the U.S. Air Force and Lockheed Skunk Works. So, no, it's all very interesting, and we would like to see where this leads, but it's also true that we've heard this song before, and I'm not trying to minimize any of this, but if this is going to be something where it's just an attempt to monetize the UFO field, then I don't know how serious it really is going to be. If it's something that really is going to be insiders trying to make a breakthrough and a disruptive breakthrough at that, then, well, time will tell. So,
or both.
I don't know.
Or both. Let's take some calls. First-time caller Ian in San Francisco. You're on with Richard Dolan. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Hi.
All right.
Hey, Richard, I really love your work. You know, I think you're one of the most well-spoken, and, you know, I just really appreciate everything you guys do. My question is, what do you think about the Nazca alien finding down in Peru? How credible do you find that is? And do you think things like Gaia and David Wilcox, you know, are under a lot of scrutiny or under a more of a microscope because of people like Corey Good and the journalist that's doing the, you know, that is head of the Nazca findings or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And so the Gaia has organized or has been involved in excavating, I guess, or getting access to human-looking, humanoid, alien-looking, mummy-type creatures. And this is an ongoing thing for them, and it's not my place at all to make a judgment one way or the other on it, and I won't do it. I know some of the folks at Gaia who are doing research into this. And the only thing that I will say is that they believe that they've got something that's genuine and that's really fascinating, and the rest of us are just waiting to hear, you know, what their actual findings are. And that's about all I can say on that. And in terms of speculating about some of the other folks at Gaia, I can't really, you know, speak on behalf of David Wilcock. I don't know. I really wouldn't know what to say about that. I have my own relationship to Gaia, as I mentioned earlier. I wrote and hosted a TV show that's about to air. It's on False Flags. Very different from the other kinds of material that you see on Gaia. Way more political. It's a very different sort of a thing. I think it's very interesting. So I have some insights into Gaia, but right, there's a lot in that question, and I'm not really sure where
it's like a lot of wait and see. We'll have to wait and see on a lot of it. Thank you, Ian. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Steve in upstate New York. Hi, Steve. You're on with Richard Dolan.
Yes, sir. I just want to say I'm a former Marine Corps officer. I'm currently a captain with a major airline that you fly probably several times, both of you. I fly internationally, domestic, you name it. 23 months ago, it'll be 24 in August, my first officer and I, who happened to be at the time an Air National Guard Lieutenant Colonel, F-15 and F-16 pilot, F-15 instructor, we took off out of Boise, Idaho, early in the morning, around 4:30 Boise time. Thunderstorms, name it, flying along for about an hour. And we finally break out of the thunderstorms, and it was like, you know, going through a curtain. Beautiful day, nice and sunny. And air traffic control at that time said to us that we were leading the pack. There were three other airplanes behind us, and I was en route to the East Coast. So I said, I asked him what the rides were like so I could choose another altitude. It was a little bumpy. And he said, nope, you're leading the pack. You're going to have to give me the okay, great. But I'm looking off to my left, sir, at 10 o'clock, about 5 miles, and there's an aircraft. And he looked down his radar and says, yeah, there is. Hold on for a second. And he said, well, what does it look like? What kind of aircraft is it? I said, wait, hold on. It's coming closer. Now, this is all on tape. This is factual and on tape. I've been flying 45 years. I look it out my window. It comes to my 11 o'clock position, and it's now within 1 mile of me. And this is in a matter of seconds. And I said to him, sir, I gave him my full name, my flight number, and my airline name, and he knew what my flight number and my airline name was. I was sick and tired of the whole cloak and dagger of this.
You're putting it on the record on purpose, then.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
You bet. Yeah. And I just said, I want someone to call me at my house about this, because I'm ready to talk. And if they want to try and make me out to be a fool, go for it. I dare you. Anyway, I put my name on the record. I'm looking at this thing, and I said, you know what, sir, I'll tell you what kind of aircraft it is. It isn't. It doesn't have wings. It's oval. That's all I can tell. I don't know what side I'm looking at. I said it on the radio. I said, it could be a profile view. I don't know. It's about 1,000 feet long. It's silver, and it's reflecting the sun. It's not spinning. It doesn't look like a cartoon flying saucer. It's a oval-shaped silver object that's toying with my airplane that I'm doing 550 miles an hour. And I looked at my co-pilot, and I said, do you see what I see? And he says, yes, I do. I said, can I reference you on the radio? And he said, yes, I can. Mm-hmm. All right. So I referenced him and myself. And, you know, this is the first time I'm able to tell you and the public. And this is not the first time I've seen things like this. Flying over the ocean, flying over the North Pole, from Germany, going to Anchorage, going to Hawaii. But this is the first time I've actually had an up-close view, and I did not have my phone or in camera within reach at the time, because I was afraid that this thing was going to get in my way, and I actually put my hands on the controls and was ready to kick off the autopilot and actually fly this airplane like a fighter. Because
sir, if I may ask you, first of all, I'm very glad that you are mentioning this sighting. I'm sure people listening feel the same way. So how did this sighting end?
What happened?
That's very interesting. So I tell Air Traffic Control everything I told you. Do you think they'd even respond or acknowledge my comment? No. So then I hear behind us a United crew mention, we see the same thing. After this thing disappeared out of my sight, about, I'd say, 30 seconds later. Now, this United guy was 35 miles behind me. 30 seconds later, he said he saw the same thing.
Yeah.
No response from air traffic control. None. I tried for about a month to get the tapes. They won't release them. You don't need those tapes. And I don't know if this is a false thing, but on the Internet, and this was right around Fargo, North Dakota, and I can't give you an exact point, but I remember seeing it on my screen in front of me, Fargo, North Dakota, Minot, North Dakota, in that area. But you can Google something on the Internet, and it says something, somebody saw something in Fargo. But, you know, I don't care about stuff like that. The reason why I'm calling you, sir, is because I'm on my way home right now from JFK to upstate New York, driving home. There were delays tonight, and I'm in uniform, and I'm actually pulled off to the side because I have a carrier that I don't rely on, and I don't want to lose this call. So,
well, thank you. I want to thank you. By the way, I'll be in upstate New York, back home in a couple of days myself. That's where I live. I think cases like this are potentially explosive cases. I think investigators would love to dig into the details of your particular incident, primarily because it seems seemingly not just yourself, but a number of other pilot witnesses saw this and can speak to it. The fact that there's no FAA records seemingly available, that's interesting, but we might be able to, the researcher might be able to do some FOIA requests. There might be things that can come out as a result of this. And, you know, it's a fascinating sighting that you had, I have to say.
That's a really great case. Steve, yeah. If you will leave your contact information with Donna on the phone, we'll get in touch with you, and we can put some pressure on FAA to cough up the tape of the records. And
August 2015 is when this happened, I guess.
Do you have an exact date, Steve?
Written down at home in my logbook.
Okay. You would just hang on for a second and leave the information, and we'll be in touch with you and see where this can go.
And if I could just bring it into a disclosure context, because you know we're in an era now where I mean sightings are very common, of course, but increasingly because we're able to communicate with each other so much more easily than before, I keep having this little mental fantasy that there will be a sighting that hits the sweet spot, so to speak, and that ball goes out of the park. In other words, a sighting that is so good that is seen by enough individuals who are credible witnesses, who've got data to support themselves, and that gets enough media traction that it causes a problem for the secrecy. And I retain a belief that this type of a case can happen, such a case can happen.
Steve, has there been any repercussions as you're trying to get the... I'm sorry. He's gone. We'd like to maybe hear from him again. Okay.
I think it was fascinating. It was a fascinating sighting.
That's a pretty interesting case.
And he seemed like absolutely straight-laced, reliable sort of witness. I mean, we only heard him on the phone, but conceivably someone could interview him and his colleagues and get a detailed statement.
Yeah, he sounds fed up. We'll try to get one more quick call in before the end of the hour on the international line. We got Chris in Mira Loma. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, I was just trying to call to give you a quick clue. I live in Mira Loma, California, and I was basically informed on, of all things, cable, that there was a possibility there was a place to where spaceships come through around a star, the Orion's Belt, and I don't search for them. I just went outside and looked in the sky, and I looked, and I saw these things come out of a hole like nothing, like they were from like a space shuttle coming down. You don't see them, and all of a sudden you see them. And it's right next door to, like, a naval base.
Okay.
And I looked, and I kept counting. I was like, what the hell is that? And I live next to the Ontario Airport, which the planes go straight. And these things were going forward, but they were going left to right at the same time.
Chris, did you take a photo?
I was trying to take a photo. I was going to go in the house and get a camera, and I didn't think I would be able to find my camera in time enough. And I actually went inside and told somebody what I saw and went in the front yard, and they were still coming. I was in the backyard, and I saw them. When I saw, like, about 11 white spots, I was like, what the heck is this?
I'll tell you what, Chris, we're out of time, so maybe you could leave your information as well, and we'll see if we can get back to you and find a way to confirm that. Thanks for all of our callers. Rich, any predictions? Anything interesting coming in the next year?
Well, big predictions in, regarding the state of the world, I'm afraid to make them because I think we're moving into very tumultuous times. And if there is any kind of secrecy that comes out, like a disclosure, which I'm not expecting, but if it were, I think it'll be many, many years before things settle out and we actually get to something called the truth. I think, you know, the one thing I would say about it, any potential UFO disclosure is that I would expect it to be filled with spin and deception. I would not expect it to be a truthful disclosure. At least not willingly. There's too much invested in this secret to make it a done deal. If anyone's going to, you know, have this great idea, we're going to let the secret out. I think there'll be a lot of pushback on it. As far as my own projects, I'll tell people look out if they want to check out what I'm doing on Gaia TV. My show on false flags is about to air, and I am working on my book on false flags. Check my website, richardolanpress.com. You can check it out.
Hope you'll come back and talk to me about it.
Would love to.
All right, Richard Dolan, thanks very much. The latest book is UFOs and Disclosure in the Trump Era. We have a link to it on our website. Thanks also to Jan Harzan for calling in about the MUFON conference. And all you MUFON folks, hope you enjoy yourself here in Las Vegas. We'll be right back with John Hansen live from the UK. Stick around, and Cream, Crossroads, takes us into the break.